You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Today, finally, we're in Paris.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney, and we have arrived in Paris on the final Sunday of the Tour de France. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Lionel.
Hello.
Richard's not here.
No, Richard isn't here. Richard is in Glasgow, or on his way to Glasgow for the Commonwealth Games. We've found a little pavement cafe, actually quite a chic-looking wine bar, got quite a nice wine list. We've ordered a cheese salad for lunch, I think, with the recommended white wine that goes with it. Is that right?
It is. Grave. Bordeaux.
Very nice. So we're looking forward to that turning up. There's about an hour to go in the women's race, La Course, which is taking place a few streets over from here. We're not far from the Place de la Concorde and the Rue de Rivoli. And we've arrived just to wrap up the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. And we're going to recap the race a little bit. Daniel, what are your outstanding memories of the Tour de France 2014?
I'm just looking at the papers from this morning, Lionel, and obviously we've got summaries of yesterday's events. I keep very, very excited about the performance of the French riders yesterday. The headline on the front page is Goose Pimples, roughly translated. And they're talking about what an emotional day it was yesterday, watching Jean-Christophe Perrault and Thibaut Pinot make it onto the podium. So, I mean, that in itself has been one of the highlights, hasn't it? The French Renaissance that we've been talking about for years, sort of bubbling under and finally really coming to fruition this year. And then also got the Journal du Dimanche, which is
Brian Cookson's favourite newspaper.
Yeah, and notorious before the tour for breaking the story about Chris Froome's TUE. And they've actually got quite a nice interview in there this morning with Vincenzo Nibali's father, who has repeated things that he said in various other interviews during this tour about he's going to gouge Vincenzo's eyes out if ever he gets caught doping or ever he dopes. He won't be allowed to set foot in Sicily again. But that's, yeah, quite a nice story. And also an interview with Julien Absalon, the former mountain biker who spent a lot of time with Jean-Christophe Perrault when Perrault was a mountain biker. And Absalon is sort of echoing comments by Perrault's team in the last few days to the effect that, you know, it's a shame he didn't turn pro on the road earlier because he's someone with considerable physical potential, and this is really his rightful place in the upper echelons of the general classification in the Tour de France.
Indeed. Well, it's certainly been Vincenzo Nibali's tour, hasn't he? He's led more or less from the start. He took the yellow jersey in Sheffield after that late breakaway, kind of world championship winning-esque escape on the run into Sheffield. Before that, Marcel Kittel won the opening stage in Harrogate. Mark Cavendish crashed out, of course, on the first day. That was a big story for us British journalists. And then a few days later, Chris Froome crashed and then pulled out before the race even reached the cobbles. And that, I suppose, looking back, that cobbled stage was where Vincenzo Nibali really put the seal on the Tour de France. He gained 2.5 minutes over just about everybody and more. And that set him up, put him in the driving seat before we even reached the Vosges Mountains, where of course Alberto Contador then crashed out, and that really left Nibali clear to take the Tour de France more or less unchallenged, would you say?
You talked about Sheffield there, and I remember standing at the finish there and talking to Beppe Martinelli, who's Vincenzo Nibali's director sportif at Astana, and you know, he was talking about the confidence boost that Nibali had got from winning the Italian National Championship a week earlier. And there was a sense there that Astana were ready to surf the crest of a wave, that, you know, they were in one of those sort of mindsets where everything just seemed to be going exactly right, and Nibali was making very sort of lucid decisions in races. But on the other hand, it did also feel that, you know, their tour at that stage had almost been made by Nibali winning the stage and getting the yellow jersey for a day. It was almost as though they didn't really expect too much more out of the tour. And that all changed, of course, when we got to the cobbles, and Nibali really delivered an absolute masterclass of bike handling. And Astana, not just Nibali, because Jakob Fuglsang was incredible that day as well. And from that point, everyone else was very much playing catch-up, weren't they?
Yeah, I think you're right there about Astana on the cobbles. They really executed a plan there. Luva-Westra as well was another key player in the coup that Astana pulled off that day. But the race really changed completely with Contador's crash. Still, the circumstances of that crash are something of a mystery, and not an awful lot has come out in the wash to explain what happened. But clearly, the injury has been significant, because we now know he won't ride the Vuelta a España either. So we may not see Alberto Contador back at his best this season, but it does set us up for a real battle next year, not just the emergence of Thibaut Pinot and Romain Bardet for the French, but the fact that Nairo Quintana, one of the best Grand Tour riders in the world, winner of the Giro d'Italia earlier this season, he wasn't here. And then you have to assume that Chris Froome and Contador and Nibali will all be back to contest the Tour de France again next year. But we've seen some new riders emerging, not just Pinot and Bardet, but the Polish climber, I suppose you have to call him a climber, climbing specialist, Rafał Majka. And again, it's one of these situations where you see a rider like that win two stages and the King of the Mountains the way he did, and it, almost his previous career is almost... it's almost forgotten, the fact that he's finished sixth and seventh in successive Giros. So, you know, it's not like he's a flash in the pan, but he's certainly got his head to ride for himself once Contador had to pull out.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of talk in this Tour de France about plans B. And, you know, Team Sky failed to come up with a valid one or a successful one once Chris Froome crashed out. Richie Porte, we always sort of harboured some doubts about his kind of resilience over 3 weeks. Was he going to have a bad day? Was he not? Unfortunately for him, it turned out to be the case. He right from the Alps, really, the first big Alpine stage to Chamrousse, he was sort of found wanting. It seems to have been due to illness, and he's carried that illness into the rest of the race, and it's really hampered his performance. But then, you know, Garmin Sharp were another team that were left short. Andrew Talensky also had a very bad day, and then they couldn't really come up with any decent contingency plan until Navardauskas won in the last week. But then on the other hand, we had one team, Tinkoff Saxo Bank, really executed a fantastic plan B, in the sense that Micah came very much to the fore and won two stages. Michael Rogers won in the Pyrenees, so they were one of the big success stories of the Tour as well in the end.
Absolutely. And just before we tuck into our lunch, just look back at some of the other highlights. Marcel Kittel's sprinting, of course, in the early stages. He tired quite rapidly, and already by, I think, the stage that left from Arras to Reims, which was won by André Greipel, he was already not firing quite as strongly as he had been in the previous days. And it remains to be seen, we're still a few hours away from the final sprint on the Champs-Élysées here in Paris, but it remains to be seen whether he's recovered from those mountain stages enough to produce a stage-winning sprint at the end. It may well be that we see Alexander Kristoff, who won two stages for Katusha, the Norwegian rider, who, again, another one of these sort of emerging riders who comes to the Tour de France and finds his profile catapulting upwards. But a lot of people overlooking the fact that he won Milan-San Remo earlier in the spring. So it's been a tour that has confirmed talent as well as revealed it, I think. And certainly as we've got into the third week of the race, with the race for the yellow jersey pretty much done and dusted, really, after, well, really, if we're being honest, after the Alps, it was Nibali's lead was so secure, it would have taken a calamity, which no one really would have wanted to see him get ill or injured or crash. So the tour was, from an overall perspective, was done and dusted. So it's been about those side stories. And quick mention for Tony Martin as well, who turned a road stage into a time trial, really, by breaking away 50 odd kilometres from the end, and then did what he does best in the final time trial from Bergerac de Périgueux on Saturday.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Lionel Burney and Daniel Freib.
So this is the final Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, of the 2014 Tour de France. I'm Lionel Burney, I'm in Paris with Daniel Freib. And yesterday, Daniel, you were paying quite close attention to the yellow jersey press conference given by Vincenzo Nibali. And it was slightly peculiar, wasn't it?
It was a bit of a shambles, to be honest, Lionel. Usually in press conferences, the stage winner or the yellow jersey sits in a video car by the finish line, and you can either, as a journalist, you can either go into the video car and ask questions live, as it were, face to face, or you can sit in the press room and there's a video link up, and translations are usually provided afterwards, after the press conference, if it's in a language other than French, and yesterday, well, as always happens with the winner's press conference or the champion-elect press conference, they actually come into the press room, which used to happen every day on the tour when I first started doing the tour, but now only happens on the penultimate day. And Nibali came in, and people had been provided with headphones beforehand, and there were various different channels. You could listen in various different languages, so there was a real-time translation.
Yeah, you could listen in French or Italian or English, or if you wanted, you could listen to the cycling podcast, I think.
So it quite quickly became obvious that the questions were not being translated very well, because Nibali was asked several questions related to doping, and pretty much they were pretty much invariably mangled to the extent that the answer was completely unrecognisable from the question. So, for example, I think at one stage, Nibali was asked whether he'd be happy for his blood and urine samples to be stored, kept after this Tour de France and maybe tested in future, retested. And I think his response was something along the lines of, yeah, I'm really looking forward to coming back to the Tour de France next year. I'd also like to do the Giro again, but yeah, of course, I'd like to defend my title. And it continued pretty much in that vein. I mean, and it's not great, is it, when, you know, we know how much scrutiny the yellow jersey wearer is under, the Tour winner is under, and there's so much expectation that they, you know, send out a clear message as regards doping. I mean, it's become an issue again in the last 10 days, particularly, you know, when Nibali had been in the yellow jersey for 3 or 4 days, people started to ask the sort of doping questions. And yeah, it's a very important issue. And yesterday, the journalists and also the public were denied the opportunity to hear what he really thinks about certain things because of poor translation in the press conference.
Well, sticking with Vincenzo Nibali, the big question, I suppose, of this tour is, would he have won if Alberto Contador and Chris Froome had not crashed out? It's fair to say that Nibali came into the race as a third favourite as best. So over the last 2 or 3 days, Richard Moore and myself have been around the start village asking journalists, riders and team managers that very question. The question we posed was, would Vincenzo Nibali have won the tour if Alberto Contador and Chris Froome had not crashed out?
Alan Laseca, DEA, newspaper in the Basque Country.
Difficult to say. I think it will be a good battle for the tour with Froome and Contador. We never know what happens, but I think Contador was stronger than Nibali. I think this was the tour of Contador, but we never know. Nibali is the best, Contador is not here, Froome is not here, and Nibali wins the tour clearly. No.
Laura Messiger, Eurosport.
Good question. I don't know. He started really, really good. I think with his victory in the second stage that nobody was expecting, he was very, very clever. How can you know this? What do you think?
What do I think? I'm asking you.
Contador was in a super good shape, and all the Spanish riders that know him very well said it also. Vincenzo has proved that he's really good in the Grand Tour, so yeah, I think why not?
Matt Bowden, Velo News.
Ah, Richard, you media guys are always trying to stir up controversy in the ranks, aren't you? You want me to speak to this? It's pure conjecture, but I'll answer it anyway because I love this stuff. I think that he would have. I think that he took enough on the cobbled stage and has been thorough enough in the mountains to show that he may have lost time to those guys on the hardest summit finishes, but I don't think they would have taken 2 minutes out of him over the course of, what, four mountain days. So I think he would have won. I think we're seeing the guy who would have been the rightful winner, and it's been great to watch him ride because it's exciting, and he's not just racing for Paris now, he's racing for history.
Matt White.
Totally irrelevant. He's the best bike rider here, and he's totally deserves a win if he can win by the end of the week. It certainly would have been interesting, but he's proved he's been the dominant force in this year's tour. But it would have been nice for him to go head to head with those two guys, but that's cycling. You've got to make your own luck, and they certainly did a great job in doing that as well.
Oh, hello. In no preparation here on it. Go on then.
Hit away, fire away.
Rod Ellingworth, Team Sky.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. Don't see why not. The speed he went up that climb yesterday, I think, was pretty quick. It's the tour, isn't it? And I think part of it is staying on your bike. Has he had a crash? I don't think he's had a crash. So he hasn't had a crash because You know, he's just been on his game, hasn't he? And I think that's the difference. Fumi crashed in the neutralise of the first stage last year, didn't he? But, you know, I don't think he fell any other day. So it's one of them, isn't it? I think you have luck, but you also create your own luck. So I think he's, you know, fair play to him. He's ridden well and he's fit and he's kept his health, everything. Just all gone very well for him, hasn't it?
Tim Harris, former British professional road race champion, now a driver on the Tour de France.
Well, I have to say it's quite a shame that they both crashed out, but the way he's been going, I think it would have been one of the most spectacular tours in history. Whether they won it or not, we're never going to know. So we'll have to wait until this time next year, I think. Because at the end of the day, you can only beat the people who you beat. If other people have fallen off or taken more risk on the descent, and if the opposition, for whatever reason, are not here, then it doesn't really detract at all, because the history books will go down that he's won the Tour de France, and that's forever.
Charlie Wigelius, the sports director of Garmin Sharp.
If my brother was a girl, he'd be my sister. I don't know. But I'm pretty sure that with the way he's going, Contador and Froome would have had their hands full to beat him. So one of the three for sure, and I think he's going good.
Brian Holm, the sports director of Amiga Pharma Quickstep.
And hopefully Nibali. I think he rode here last 3 weeks like a true champion. We saw him on the cobblestones. He was third to Arnberg, and already there he was winning the stage to Sheffield. I think from the start he was the very best, and he got an extremely good team. They always kept him out of trouble. He didn't crash. He excellent downhill. He's one of the best in the whole peloton. End of the day, I think he would have won the Tour, and I think he's a brilliant winner of Tour de France.
Chris Horner, a rider with Lamprey.
Would change the whole dynamic of the race to have those two guys still in. Clearly he's on really good form. Would have been a good show, maybe for the fans at home, something more to watch for the overall. Been a really good race, I think, exciting race too, especially for the podium and all that stuff. But whether if he wins or not, nobody knows that one. But he's beat those guys many times in the past, and they've beat him, so it seems to be a pretty fair fight amongst the two.
Jan-Peter de Vlieger of Het Nieuwsblad.
I would say no. I think he would have been really, really close. I think these two would have a little edge on him. Well, I read today that his power outputs are not the same that Chris Froome had last year. Quite close, but not entirely the same. I think he would have been just a little bit behind him. I think he doesn't have the acceleration that those two have. He would have been not able to match their acceleration. That's how I see it.
Marc Sergent, team manager of Lotto Bellisol.
Victory was for one of those two. Why not here? If you ask me the same question, I should have said Nibali is the favourite for third spot. So that says enough.
Thomas Carreau, top man in the press office at the Tour de France.
We cannot say if he would have won the Tour. I guess the Tour would have been definitely different. Maybe we would have had a very strong battle between the Contador Froome and Nibali on the Alps and the Pyrenees. Nibali could have won the Tour because he has shown much power on the mountains. He has shown a very strong attitude on the cobblestones. So I think he's a great winner for the Tour. We cannot complain because it's been 30 years we are waiting to have two Frenchmen on the podium.
William Fotheringham.
Yes.
Rupert Guinness, Sydney Morning Herald.
I think without doubt the Tour would have been a three-horse race with Nibali, Contador and Froome. I actually still believe that if is a big word in capitals, but I think Contador would have been the rider who would have won. I think we've seen the strength of his team since, so he obviously had some exceptionally strong riders on Tinkoff Saxo. Nibali's obviously been strong and so is his team, but I think Contador's team would have been able to capitalise on the energy that Astana have had to use to defend that jersey. Yeah, Nibali's a guy who likes to lead from the front of a race. He won the Giro that way and he used his team that way by defending it for a long time. Tinkoff Saxo would have capitalised on that. So I still think he's the guy I think would have, but the winner is the winner.
Tom Carey, Telegraph cycling correspondent.
Ooh, I'm still going to go with, I think Chris Froome would have done it actually, despite, you know, this guy's travails in this race. I think they would have retained their motivation. I think he's still the best Grand Tour rider out there.
So Marco Pinotti, BMC.
I still think that Nibali
surely would have been very, very close, because at the point when Contador crashed, he had 2 minutes and a half, and so they had already one climb finish, not the hardest one, but he didn't lose any second. And with Froome, the way he came out from Dauphiné, it's fair to say that it wouldn't be easy for them to be faster than Nibali, because the way the season came out with Nibali, he had some problem with the baby born, which was a little bit late in the season. He picked perfectly for the two, while the other, they kind of fight each other a lot during Dauphiné, so this take out a lot of energy. So my opinion, when they asked me before the start was the favorite for the two, I already put Nibali in the top three without knowing anything. So, and then probably is Nibali is the level of last year Giro, and if you look at his palmarès in the Grand Tour the last 4 years, is impressive. He always be finished top three. So for me, it's not a surprise. No.
David Walsh,
I don't think so. Don't think he would have beaten both. I'm not sure which one might have beaten him, but Contador got one chance on a very short climb to see could he put Nibali under pressure, and he did, and he just at the end broke him, and I thought that was a portent of things to come, but obviously he never got the chance. I think Froome was going really well on that very first day, well, second day into Sheffield, when Froome made his attack, short little dart on a steep hill. Nibali wasn't able to go with him. Now Nibali won the stage. He won the stage because after Froome went and everybody had made the effort to bring him back, everybody was vulnerable, and they waited for Froome to go and chase him down, and Froome wouldn't do it. So Nibali did the intelligent thing. He's ridden really well. He was brilliant on the cobbles. But my feeling from knowing what Froome had done when they had done the recon on the cobbles, that if Froome had been right, he would have done a very good cobble stage as well. Overall, I don't think Nibali would have beaten both. And I think if you put Quintana in there, I definitely don't think, because what he did in the Giro, what he did in the Tour last year, would indicate that he's the best climber of all. And there was always so many mountains in this race that if somebody was climbing really well, the time trial was going to be irrelevant.
So Daniel, one very important person that wasn't asked in that package is yourself. What's your response to that question? Would Nibali have won if Contador and Froome had been able to contest it all the way to Paris?
I'm really, really not sure to give an obvious answer. I mean, one phenomenon we saw in this tour, and I think this is very, very relevant to the French riders who did so well, Bardet, Perrault and Pinot. They were, I think, emboldened by Contador and Froome being taken out of the race. And you know, those two riders in particular have a kind of X factor, which I think intimidates certain riders, and they Pino certainly before the tour felt that those two riders were out of his reach, belonged to a sort of different bracket of Grand Tour rider, and I think Nibali's attitude and Astana's attitude was altered obviously by the fact that those two teams were out, and not just the riders themselves but their teams. You know, Sky still had some bearing on the race, actually not a great bearing, and Tinkoff, Saxo certainly did, but not in the way they would have done. And we saw a very open race because of Sky's absence in particular. And I think it would have changed the race completely. Having said that, there's no doubt that Nibali was in absolutely superlative condition. He rode to, you know, the skill level and the management of the race. He was absolutely faultless, really. I think he would have been close to Froome. And I think he would have tested Froome in ways that he wasn't tested last year, in terms of, you know, improvisation, attacking in places where Froome perhaps wouldn't have expected it, and Contador as well would have done the same.
Yeah, I think that Nibali's win just proves something that is blindingly obvious, and sometimes journalists get sort of mocked for stating the obvious, that in order to win the Tour de France, you first have to not lose it. And by that, I mean, don't lose time on silly stages. Don't get caught up in the crashes, which are pretty much routine in the first week, particularly when everyone's so nervous. I mean, there's a number of factors, I think. The fact that Yorkshire was so crowded with so many fans, narrowing the roads in places, it led to quite sort of neutralised racing at times. They didn't take risks when they didn't have to, but it did mean that everybody was racing right on the limit of their nerves and wits, I think, for two, perhaps 3 days, with the stage into London as well, because it rained that day. And then they got back to France and there was almost a relief that the race resumed normality and the Tour de France could kind of begin. And that's really when the serious crashes started to happen. And it's when, in those moments, Chris Froome's crash, when he looks back, a nothing crash in the very early stages of a race, which caused him problems that, you know, you wouldn't have wanted that crash fracturing a bone in his wrist at any time in the race, of course. But the day before the cobbles gave him absolutely no time to assess the injury, maybe get a splint made for it. And I mean, riders can carry on with a fractured bone in the wrist if it's not too debilitating. But on the cobbled stage, you know, that must have played significantly on his mind. And when you look at the podium and perhaps the top six places, really only TJ Van Garderen had a significant crash. He crashed on the stage too. I'm testing my memory here. It was the day that Sagan lost out by half a centimetre.
Nancy. Stage, I think, six.
Yeah, so the day that Mattia Trentin beat Sagan by a whisker, that was the day that Van Garderen crashed and lost a bit of time on the run-in. I think that's the unifying factor for the top six places on GC, is that they suffered relatively few mishaps.
Yeah, and you know, perhaps not for Nibali, perhaps not for someone who's trying to win the Tour, but for places 2 to 6 in that first week, you know, it was really about damage limitation. I mean, we saw with Pino, he lost time due to bad placement, and you know, the old sort of criticisms started to be aired that, you know, his bike craft is kind of amateurish, and you know, he was going to lose more time on descents in the mountains. But actually, he stayed quite cool in the face of that criticism, because I think he knew that, you know, losing 1-2 minutes wasn't that disastrous, and the most important thing was, like you say, Lionel, he hadn't crashed. And you know, we've seen that, we've talked about it before in the Tour, we've talked about whatever you say about Lance Armstrong, his almost miraculous ability to avoid that kind of mishap. And you know, as we've said on numerous occasions, that is very much part of what goes into making a Tour winner.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Well, we're going to head off over to the Place de la Concorde, in the area where the team buses will be gathering. We're going to catch up a little bit with La Course, the women's race that's preceded the men's stage of the Tour de France today. Quite a momentous occasion for women's cycling to have an event that's on quite such a stage as this in the centre of Paris on the final day of the Tour de France. But while we head off over there, here's an interview that we did with Dave Brailsford as the Tour came to a close, and he was in sort of reflective mood looking back at the Tour de France, but also explaining a little bit the work that Team Sky will do to get their season back on track.
So Dave, I remember speaking to you a lot in the 2010 Tour, your first ever Tour de France, which was also a disappointing Tour. Are there comparable things about this Tour and that Tour, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think we started out with a pretty bold ambition with, you know, when we started Team Sky, it was our first season. There was a lot of, there's a lot to learn really, in terms of not so much the actual bike racing itself, but the behind the scenes stuff, you know, the how to get things moved around. And there's an awful lot of work that we were, you know, burdening ourselves with. And I think when we came in for the first time, we felt that we looked up the top of that GC, and it felt an awful long way away, and it was a bit that was a bit scary, to be honest. And you think,
I mean,
wow,
it's okay. Humbling at the time as well, the whole experience.
Yeah. I think anytime you lose, anytime you don't win, it's humbling. The emotion of losing for me, or the emotion of not winning for me, as a person inside me, you know, it's not maybe not how I behave, but inside me, it's not pleasant. It's not good in my head when we don't win. It's not a nice place to be. And I think a lot of it is, you know, when people say I don't celebrate winning enough, and people say, well, you know, you kind of win and you move on. And I know it's not necessarily a good way of doing it, but that's genuinely what happens in my head, is that, you know, you set out to achieve something, you achieve something, it's like, great, on to the next thing. And I don't feel the need to kind of go crazy about it or anything. But then I guess a little bit of it is that the whenever it doesn't go to plan, or for whatever reason we don't win, it's the avoidance of that in my head, and the avoidance of what happens, I think, which is probably the reason I'm still doing
what drives you.
Yeah,
I mean, you learned a lot in that 2010 Tour. Has there also been a lot to learn from this one?
I think it's different insofar as it's our fifth year of doing this. And I think, you know, when you're on a voyage of discovery, as we were in 2010, it's like, wow, you look at it and you think, God, there are so many things that we could do better. And that's looking at ourselves, forget everybody else. And so you set about that, and I think we set about it with a real, you know, there's an excitement, there's fear, there's, we're not going to go back there and let that happen again. You know, there's all of those kind of emotions that really drive the team on, and some people like that, and for some people the wheels come off, you know, and you kind of start evolving your team. And then of course in 2011 we came back, and I think we felt that in actual fact the start of 2011 was a positive start. We you know, Brad got on the podium in Paris-Nice, which was great, really, and all of a sudden, from having seen, looked at any GC and being a million miles off it, all of a sudden we're on the podium in Paris-Nice, and that was a real positive jolt of or burst of energy that everybody needed, and it gave us, you know, gives you self belief. And I think once you get your self belief systems getting in place, then you're on a bit of a roll. And so then we went on, and we genuinely thought that Brad would be in the mix in 2011, broke his collarbone. But that year, you know, obviously crashed out. And I can remember the devastation of that moment when Brad crashed out, and it took a good couple of days to come to terms with that, you know. And to be fair to the lads, they went on, and Eddie won a couple of stages, didn't he? You know, which was great, you know. And then into the Welt in 2011, and I think that's where then, with Froome and Bradley getting on the podium, that's where we thought, right, this is really doable now. And I think that kind of carried us through the winter. And of course, 2011 was a pretty flawless season in that regard. So is it similar? No, because I think we've got a lot more experience now than we had then, and we won the tour twice, you know. And you think, that's why I said when we came here, people say, no, you're going to go and defend your jersey. I think, I'm not sure we are. We're going to try and win it for a third time. And that might be this year, it might be next year, it might be the year after, but we want to win it for a third time. We're going to keep on trying, and I think that's the difference. I think you, instead of just putting a series of performances of an undefeated Tour de France back to back, to what extent is that really realistic? And I think the thing, I think what we should be thinking about a little bit more as Team Sky is collecting yellow jerseys. That's what we want to do, and we'll try and collect as many as we can in the time that we've got.
You mentioned the other day that you know, you sort of established a blueprint, a formula almost for success the last couple of years, and you mentioned that you wouldn't be afraid to look at that again and really, yeah, really perhaps even rip it up and come up, yeah, with a new formula, a new blueprint.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think what I say there is you kind of the danger for us is that you kind of come up with a system or a method, and you think, right, that works. You do it again for another year and it works again. And then you think, actually, all we need to do now is roll out this method, roll out this system, and it'll work again. And it comes and bites you on the arse, quite frankly, because the world's not like that. And so it's this, you know, we talk a lot about this idea of continuously having to rethink and reinvent. And, I suppose it's like many annual seasons, you know, be it a football season or, you know, rugby, whatever else, is that you're actually going through, it's like Groundhog Day. So you've got your pre-season, you go through the motions, the tables come out, you play go to the same races and do the same thing. And I think if you stick to the same formula, all you need to do there is maybe change the intensity of the emotion around it. You're a little bit overconfident, or a little bit, you know, a little bit of, you don't quite do all the little things that got you there. It takes next to nothing, and all of a sudden, you know, you're off the mark. However, I think we've got to be clear here that I still think if Chris was still on his bike, uninjured, I think he'd have been there or thereabouts in this tour. But, you know, it's unfair or nibbly to say that, you know, that to predict anything, but he's certainly been competitive. Whereas in 2010, we weren't competitive.
So how do you do that? I mean, you famously in the past brought in experts from other areas, even from outside sport. Is that something you'll look to do again, perhaps, to seek expertise, knowledge, inputs from beyond cycling and beyond sport?
Well, I've spent most of my last 4 or 5 days, I'd say, sitting and I think driving everybody crazy, really. And I spent 6 hours yesterday in the back of the bus, you know, stuck in the back of the bus with Tim and Rod, and I've spent a lot of time with you know, the other guys in the team. So yeah, you do. You pick it all apart and you think about different ideas. And first thing to do is to try and understand this performance first, and not have a knee-jerk reaction to something and throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know. And then you sort of start start going through a process, which is you look at everything, you try and throw a spanner in the works and throw everything up in the air and see where we go.
So was that meeting primarily about looking at this race and what maybe or what could have gone better, or was it looking ahead and sort of projecting forward?
No, I think you've got to start with looking at yourself. And for me, in any kind of process like this, you know, it's all right for me to stand there and tell everybody, you know, well, the first point of reference should always be yourself and everything else. They can't say that without doing it. So for me, you know, I've kind of thought about very much about, you know, how have I done my job? And is there anything I've been missing? And have I done that to the best of my ability? Are the lads getting what they need? And, you know, you can kind of go through that first. And because if that's not right, you know, the rest won't work, that's for sure. So I think there's a start. You kind of start with a very critical self-assessment.
Have you identified anything that you could have done differently or could have done better?
I think you always can, you know. I think at the end of the day, we're human. And, you know, we'll be making mistakes right here, right now. But we don't know what they are yet. And at some point in time, we'll find out what the mistakes we're making now are, but we're not aware of them yet. So I think as long as you've got that in your mind, it's not to call people out. It's not to say, you know, you made an error. It's just how can we improve? And for sure, there's lots of different things that you can think. Actually, yeah, we could have done that differently. We could have approached this in a different way. We could have, you know, you just look at it all, and think, right, we've got to change things around. And I think, you know, it's interesting when I think about my own situation here, that in the last couple of years, I've spent an awful lot of time talking about doping, sort of defending questions about doping, looking at, you know, biological passports and all of that kind of stuff, which has been pretty full on, to be honest. And whilst I'm doing all that, I'm not thinking about performance. And I think there's an element, for me personally, I think there's an element of, right, I've got to really, it's hugely important, all of that stuff, don't get me wrong. But it'd be nice to be really able to focus back on the key aspect of performance and see what we can do.
Dave, is it really difficult to reconcile the need? You know, you talked about winning multiple Tours de France and collecting yellow jerseys. Is that not difficult to reconcile with the kind of developmental needs of the team, in the sense that, you know, we've made a point in recent days that, you know, Thibaut Pinot, one of the reasons he's doing so well now is that he was thrown in 2012 into a team that, you know, had 9 spaces up for grabs. They didn't have a GC leader to support, and he got valuable experience there. And that's why he's here now, isn't it?
I think you could have said that Thibaut Pinot was going to be here or in this kind of area about 3 years ago. We were very keen to sign him two years ago, whatever it was. I think, you know, he was an outstanding young rider, and he's one of those guys you think, you know what, he could go all the way. So I think he's, you know, then you look at the talent and the development of that talent, and I think a little bit it comes back to the Yateses, if you like, you know, where we recognise that if you've got one of the best riders in the world and you're going to try and win every race you go to, and the way you want to try and win it is have a team that's absolutely dedicated to riding in a certain way to try and win. Then if you put young guys into that particular team who aren't actually capable just yet of delivering that performance and backing it up, then what you then have is you start asking guys, the older pros as it were, to do a job and a half or a job and a quarter, and their job is hard enough as it is. And I think what then happens is they'll go, well, hold on a minute, why am I having to do a job and a quarter? You know, you should get somebody to do that job properly, you know. And I think there's all of those little undercurrents, if you like, all the little subplots that you've got to think about. And for the development of riders, I think that's why in the opportunity that the Yates have had in Edinburgh to come here and go on a break and race as they have done this year, it's been absolutely fantastic for them. And if I'm sure they will get to a level where they're competitive in, you know, I'm convinced they'll get big results. And when they do get those big results, you can say part of that is through what they've learned along the way. On the other hand, you know, I think we do have some fantastic young talents, and it's our job to make sure we've got a race programme. We talked about it quite a lot, about maybe changing our race programme, doing some smaller races just with a younger group, so that they can have those development opportunities, rather than throwing them in the bigger races where, you know, we want to go and try and win.
Is this likely to be a big winter of transition for Team Sky in terms of personnel?
What, staff or riding?
Riders, people, and staff as well. But are there Do you expect the team to look quite different next year in terms of the riders first?
I think next year when you look at the group, the core group that we've got in terms of, let's say, if we want to come back and win this race, you know, I still think that Chris is you know, one of the most competitive GC riders in the world. There's no reason not to think that. So the question then would be, how do you create a group around him which would be able to support him again to come and try and do it again? And in that sense, you know, there might be one or two changes, but, you know, it's not as if we want to go out and sign a, you know, a GC rider. I think it would be more, there are certain guys who will naturally move on, as you do, and there are certain guys that we've identified who think, you know what, I think they would fit really well in this team, and we'd like to have them.
Richie Port obviously got his chance at this tour. It hasn't worked out for him, and he was touted this year as perhaps the leader of the team at the Giro originally. What's the future for him in terms of individual GC ambitions? Do you see him reverting to a support role?
No, I think it's been a real tough one for Richie, because I think in many respects, you know, I think people may feel that, you know, oh, well, he got ill, and, you know, it's seen as a bit of a, not an excuse in any way, but it'd be seen as I don't know, it detracts from his ability, if you like. Whereas Richie, you know, he's a brilliant climber, he's a brilliant bike rider, and he got ill. And that was the issue. And I think people will then assume, because he's got ill, then actually it's something else, and he's not, you know, he shouldn't be a GC rider and all the rest of it. And I think it's unfair, really. However, you know, it still remains for him to prove that he's capable of doing that. But I don't think the door's shut on that just yet. I think there's, you know, I think to go through a Grand Tour in full health, in full form, and get to the end and go, you know what, I gave him a best shot and I just haven't got it. That's very different from somebody who was running second after 10 days. Don't forget, that was a hard 10 days, that first 10 days. And he's second on GC, which if it had been a 10-day race, which I know it's not a stupid thing to say, but if it was a week-long stage, a 10-day, you know, it'd have been there. So I wouldn't write him off because he got ill.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So we've left Paris behind us. We're on the Eurotunnel back to England. It's Sunday night. The Tour de France is over. A few hours ago, Marcel Kittel won on the Champs-Élysées, taking his fourth stage win of the Tour. A little bit before that, Marianne Vos won the inaugural edition of La Course on the Champs-Élysées as well. We spoke to Marianne after the race, and here's what she had to say about the first edition of La Course.
Marianne, can you start what it means to you to win on the Champs-Élysées and how important this is for women's cycling in general?
Well, the biggest win of today is the world is watching women's cycling and the beauty of women's cycling, and that ASO gives us this stage to show it. But of course, from the start till the finish, it's just another bike race, and we with Rubber Live wanted to show our best and show what we're showing every week, interesting racing. And I'm really happy that I could finish this up.
Marianne, perhaps doesn't look like the most challenging course, you know, laps around the Champs. Can you just talk to us about the unique challenges of that circuit?
Well, yeah, it's a different style of racing because it's really wide, and then you have the cobbles, slightly uphill to the Arc de Triomphe. It's difficult to get away because the speed is really high, and in the bunch, you're at ease, but in front, you're pushing really hard. So we knew that up front, and with the men's, it's often a bench sprint, nearly always. We try to make a hard race, to keep in control, to keep the initiative, but and I had to save my legs for the finish. And that was the challenge. The challenge is to be in the right position at the right moment.
In terms of the women's calendar, we had the Giro Rosa, which clashes, of course, with the Tour de France. Do you feel that takes away some of the spotlight from the women's racing? And do you think that UCI needs to get together with race organisers to dovetail the women's calendar with men's events so that you get higher profile when you're racing in your top races?
These talks are already going on, and that's definitely a challenge. We have beautiful races in the UCI Women's World Cup. We have great races like the Giro Rosa. And now you see here in the combination with the Tour de France, with La Course, that it gets a lot of attention, and that the fans and women, but also men around the world, are willing to see more of women's cycling. So yeah, it's a challenge to get a more balanced calendar, and I hope it can be more combined with the men, because that gives us the stage that women's cycling needs to step up further. So this was a great day for women's cycling.
Marianne, before today you'd won pretty much everything in women's cycling. There's a new race today, you've won that as well, so you have won everything. Is it hard to to stay motivated, but also to keep improving? Is it hard for you to, you know, feel like you're still working on things and still becoming a better rider?
Definitely new races motivate us to go further and to improve myself. And this year, with the coming Tour of Britain, the Women's Tour, with La Course, so much is happening in women's cycling that gives an extra boost and helps me also to stay focused and to stay motivated. It's not really difficult, because the competition is getting stronger and stronger, and to be able to stay up there and to catch up also in the team. My teammates are doing so well that you have to have a really good level, high level, to be able to race for the victory. It's great to win these races, but it also helps me to stay fresh.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So, Daniel, the Tour de France is over. Marcel Kittel won the sprint. He didn't look quite as imposing as he'd looked in the first week of the Tour, but he's had to lug that big, bulky German frame over all those mountains in the Alps and the Pyrenees.
Yeah, we said that, didn't we, earlier in the Tour, that this was going to be a really hard route, and he's one of the weaker climbers, perhaps one of the weakest climbers in the race, and he did look tired in the last 3 or 4 days. And today I think he had a lot to thank his team for, because they delivered him in a very good position, and he looked as though he was struggling at one point in the last 100 metres, but he just managed to overhaul Christophe in the end, and that's 4 stage wins for Marcel Kittel.
And Navadauskas in third. We did wonder what Garmin Sharp were doing up there. They were obviously trying to deliver him to the line. We're so used to seeing teams really master the Champs-Élysées, really dominate in those final kilometres. But it was a free-for-all, really, wasn't it? There were Europe Car up there. Arashiro was on the front for them for a bit. Omega Pharma Quickstep were trying to get involved. Garmin Sharp, as I said, were up there. Lotto looked like they had it under control for André Greipel, but he just didn't have the horsepower at the end. And, of course, Giant were in there. They didn't do a spectacular job, but they did more than enough to get Kittel to the line. But it seemed like we've seen so many of those sprint finishes come down where it's been the peloton's been in one line in an arrowhead sort of formation, but this time it was just all across the road.
Yeah, and we've seen that more and more. I mean, we've talked earlier in the Tour about how a lead out is not necessarily it's not necessarily a line of riders with a sprinter at the end and then the rest of the peloton bunch behind that rider. A lead out these days is really, it can be composed of riders from several teams, and there can be multiple trains, and it's really just about stretching the bunch out and creating space and creating room for the main sprinters to move into. And yeah, it can look a bit messy at times, but I thought Giant Shimano did a pretty good job today, and they needed to, like I say, because Kittel wasn't at his best.
What about La Course? We didn't see an awful lot of it because it was a long trek up from Limoges this morning up to Paris, and fighting our way through the city. I mean, you know, the Tour de France suddenly appears before you, doesn't it, when you get into the area next to the river. And you know, we caught the end of it, and we spoke to Marianne Vos afterwards. Obviously a good addition to the afternoon's racing, really, and something I'm assuming with the live TV coverage it's going to have elevated the women's cycling to a bigger audience.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it would have been nicer if the finish had been closer to the men's finish. The publicity caravan for the men's race came in between the two, so There's a three, four hour gap between the two finishes. But, you know, it's a start, isn't it? And, you know, it was Marianne Vos is such a great credit to women's cycling. You know, she could easily have pointed out the negatives today. You know, we heard her there when we spoke to her. But really, she was just full of praise for the race, and she was very excited. And she talked about how new races like this are the spur for her to keep on improving, keep on winning. So, yeah, that was nice to hear.
Absolutely. So the Tour de France 2014 is over. Vincenzo Nibali, a worthy winner. Rafa Majka, the king of the mountains. Peter Sagan, the green jersey winner, really since probably day two or three he had that in the bag. And the white jersey in the end went to Thibaut Pinot, who's third on the overall podium. AG2R won the team's prize, which, I mean, you'd have got long odds on that before the start of the race, I think.
Would you, though? I'm not sure, would you? Maybe. But they dominated it, didn't they? They absolutely did.
Yeah, I suppose Perrault and Bardet and one other is going to put them reasonably up there, but I think you probably would have thought that maybe Sky or Tinkoff Saxo, but there we go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've talked about it at length, but the performance of the French riders was a massive highlight for me, especially, you know, I keep harping on about it, but I think the way Pinot kind of overcame the demons that sort of surfaced last year in the race was a great credit to him, especially because, you know, there were a lot of people even writing him off in the first week, and, you know, he has been quite a fragile character, you know, to the point where you know, there's been talk about problems he has sleeping and problems he has getting ill before big races, and just all the kind of hallmarks of a rider who is perhaps mentally not as robust as he needs to be, but in fact he's proved that is not the case. And he really came out with all guns blazing. I think I said in the Alps that I really felt that when Contador and Froome left, that he really felt that he belonged in the sort of exalted company of like the top five in the Tour, and from then he just went from strength to strength.
Interviews and analysis. We've got the Tour de France covered. This is a Telegraph Cycling Podcast supported by Jaguar.
Before we go, we've just got to announce the winners of a few of the competitions we've been running. First up, the framed picture of the Tour de France crossing Côte de Buttertubs in Yorkshire on the opening day of the Tour. The winner of that is Mark Sinton Smith. That's Mark Smith on Twitter. If you can get in touch with us via Twitter, we'll organise getting the framed print sent to you. Then we have the pair of Oakleys in the competition we're running on Facebook. And the winner of that is Tom Bradley. We'll get in touch with you on Facebook, Tom. Congratulations. And finally, the competition to name the Dream Tour de France team. We set that on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. And after a consultation with Dave Brailsford, he wasn't keen to give away too many of his team selection tips, but we have decided that the winner is Tobias. So, Tobias, if you could get in touch with us via Twitter, @cycling_podcast, or on the Facebook page, we'll arrange for the collection of books. That's Richard Moore's Etap and a complete set of the cycling anthology to be sent to you. Congratulations to everyone, and thanks for playing.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Well, I don't know about you, Daniel, but post-tour fatigue is already setting in. We have done a lot of driving today. It's always a bit strange in Paris on the last day. The last 2 years have been quite exceptional for us as British journalists, because Chris Froome and before that Bradley Wiggins won, which made for the story kind of carried on a bit more for us, I guess. But there is very much a case of it's the last day of school and the summer holidays are about to start. Pretty much there's a high-speed evacuation from Paris, not just from the media and people working on the race, but I think the riders will be relieved to get to the hotel, you know, have a few too many drinks and catch up with their family and friends. But looking back over the 3 weeks, Daniel, have you got any outstanding high spots of this year's race?
I suppose how sort of dynamic the race was from the start, the racing, you know, and Nibali really set the tone for that on the second day in Sheffield, just with that attack on the run in there, and that really kind of lit the fuse, didn't it, for the whole race. And from there we saw sort of aggressive racing every day, and, you know, I thought the route was borderline too difficult, but You know, I thought maybe the final Pyrenean stage was one too many to a Hortecam, just because everyone looked so tired there. But even that day, we had really good racing. Personal highlights, hotels and things that were, you know, reasonable standard this year. My last one in the Dordogne was pretty nice. It's a very nice, I had some very nice runs along rivers, you know, in the morning, which I enjoyed. The weather was rotten. The company was excellent, you know, your company, Richard's company. I didn't have the privilege of travelling with you in the car, but it was generally, you know, a delight every time I did see you.
Well, you've done more than your fair share of travelling in the car today. What, I think we're going to be up to about 10 or 11 hours in the comfort of the Jaguar today by the time we get home to London or thereabouts. My highlights, I would say, just a nod to Richard's excellent book, Etape. If you look at the race as a whole, there's one stage that stands out as a possible inclusion in a sequel to Etape if Richard chooses to do Etape 2 or something, and that's the cobbled day. It was packed with drama. I think when you revisit that, you know, in months or years to come, the stories of that day will come out, and there'll be you know, it will really be a sort of layered account of what actually happened. And really, you know, Christian Prudhomme made that slightly tongue-in-cheek point about La Planche de Belfi deciding the general classification, but really Nibali won the Tour on the cobbles because he gained that time on that day, and you know, he put Contador on the back foot. Now obviously Contador crashed, but he still, you know, he still opened the door on that day. And just from my point of view, being out there on the last section of cobbles and trying to capture some of the atmosphere of the day, that was probably my highlight. If you want to listen to the little package I put together, it's in the Stage 5 edition of the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. So I guess that's pretty much it, Daniel.
Yeah, it's quite sad, isn't it?
It is, but the cycling podcast isn't going away. We'll take a little break and we'll be back with weekly episodes and perhaps more regular episodes as the Vuelta a España and Tour of Britain come along. We're working on some plans to that effect. But I guess that just leaves us to thank a few people. Richard Moore, of course, who's not here. He's up at the Commonwealth Games covering the wrestling or boxing or whatever it was he was doing. He's been our consummate host for the past 3 weeks. Then behind the scenes, we've got John Mooney, who's edited every episode brilliantly for us, and Paul Scoins, who's been there offering help and support as well. Nigel Brown of Dirt and Glory Media. Who else? We need to obviously thank
Chira, of course, Guagnamiglio, and who's been, well, it's, you know, you can't, words don't really describe.
Unique, really, unique.
Francois Thomazeau as well, a good addition to the podcast, wasn't he?
Absolutely, I think we'll be making a big money signing, move, yeah. Big money move for him for next summer. And of course, the Telegraph and their correspondent Tom Carey, who's been out on the race, and also John McCleary back in London, and all the team there. And of course, Jaguar for supporting us through the tour. That's been much appreciated too. So, that pretty much is it. Other than, of course, to thank all of our listeners. I think we've had about 750,000 downloads since the tour started, which is a fantastic result for us.
Not much abuse either, yet.
Not much abuse. Not much abuse.
Gates might open now.
Don't put ideas in people's heads, Daniel.
No, you know, the tweeting has been in the spirit of the game, and, you know, it's Queensbury rules, hasn't it?
It has indeed. It's been fantastic to hear from so many of our listeners on Twitter and Facebook. Sorry we haven't been able to reply to everyone, but we've been pretty busy doing a lot of driving and hoping that we can make it to restaurants in time for dinner. But yeah, thank you to all of our listeners. We're really pleased that you came on the 2014 Tour de France with us, and we hope you join us again sometime soon.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.